Well, thank you for showing up and thanks for the invitation to be here this morning. Well, we've even got an office. I thought, well, I should come here earlier and spend time there. It's really great. So what I'm going to tell you a little bit about today is sort of a chemist view of RNA-ligand interactions. And so the title is Exploring Exploiting RNA-ligand interactions. And I know physicists like to use transparencies, but I've been using transparency from the very beginning. So it's very informal. I just moved transparencies around, so it's very easy to improvise and to be very open for questions. So please don't hesitate, and let's make it just a conversation rather than a lecture. So what we're dealing with here, and just to put things in perspective, and a little bit of history, just for the fun of it, is with a problem of information flow. All of you, probably because it's the last day of a 3 week talks about those things, are probably recognizing the importance of the genetic blueprint of a cell where all the information essentially is stored in the DNA, and of course replication, faithful replication is essential for the well-being of an organism and of course for the well-being of any cell. The information that flows from DNA to proteins is of course critical. Now this is not, I mean by now those things are pretty obvious for us, but let's just take a quick look at how things evolved. And that goes back 70, 80 years only, where people started recognizing the importance of nucleic acids to basically what we would call nowadays molecular biology. And one of the early experiments show that you can take a non-virulent strains of pneumonia and mix it with essentially dead cells and suddenly turn it into a deadly cell. And that already indicated that there's something at the sort of chemistry level that might be doing that. Of course, everybody recognizes those classical experiments in the 40s that basically started pointing us at the direction of nucleic acids, at DNA, as the storage point of information. So people at that point recognized that genes are not exactly proteins, but it wasn't really obvious how DNA actually carries all this information forward. So of course the missing part was somehow we need to get into a molecule that will mediate this information flow from what is a nucleic acid to a protein. And it's actually quite intriguing to learn how RNA was put into the picture. Again, about the same time, late 30s, people recognized that in rapidly dividing cells, what they called at the time pentose nucleotides, it's just the old name for RNA, was present in large amounts. It wasn't really obvious what was going on, but shortly afterwards, Claude discovered those RNA-rich particles, sort of insoluble things that float in the cell, and the early name for those things were, of course, the microsomes. Now we call them ribosomes. And intriguingly, I think, you all recognize that this gap between the 40s and the late 40s, there was a big thing happening in the world, of course, the big war, and not too much science was going on at the time. And this is actually the first symposium after the war taking place in Cambridge, and Berchet actually had some very interesting results, and he speculated that these insoluble RNA-rich particles are actually where protein synthesis is taking place. That was really a speculation, and he actually had some wonderful data, but his data actually confused the community for a little while, because when he was isolating ribosomes from cells, he found out that if he isolated ribosomes from, let's say, red blood cells, he found a small amount of hemoglobin touched. If he went after ribosomes from pancreatic cells, he found insulin. And that was really great on one hand, but really confusing on the other, because that led to this hypothesis that now we recognize was wrong, that one gene, one ribosome, one protein, namely each ribosome in the cell is making a single protein. That was of course incorrect, But this data was sort of led the community to recognize this hypothesis that, of course, later was dismissed. A minor discovery of the DNA structure in the early 50s sort of distracted the community from RNA, but very quickly people realized that although the structure of DNA is now more or less clear and it can explain replication, it still doesn't solve the problem of the information flow from DNA to proteins. So the focus was actually went back to RNA. And it was Crick, the same Crick from Watson and Crick, that came up with the adapter hypothesis. Yes?
Is there some obvious reason that why RNA is needed?
Well, the initial puzzle was, look, I haven't shown you actually the structure, so maybe I'll do that. We'll let me just open things up and maybe bring the chemistry forward, and then we will recognize maybe the so we started already improvising, but that's okay. So here's the structure of DNA. It's a deoxyribopolyphosphate backbone where heterocycles that actually carry the information are connected to the 1' position in any sugar. And we'll recognize in just a second that they're very, very similar both in DNA and RNA. So here are what you probably are familiar with, the G, C, A, and T. And I think the answer to your question will come up in just a second. They're just what we know nowadays about the structure. A DNA typically is a double helical. Of course, this is not the way it will be found in the chromosomes. But these are the Watson-Crick base pairs that explain initially DNA structure and replication. So now RNA is chemically very related. And you can see that the heterocycles are essentially the same, G, C, A, and U. The only difference chemically between DNA and RNA is one modification here on the pyrimidine, where you have a methyl in DNA, and of course the presence of a 2' hydroxyl in RNA, which is very critical to the structure and stability of RNA.
But that would prevent the ribosomes
from... No. We're not there yet. We're getting there in just 1 second. The answer would be probably basically localization, but if you think about hypothetically whether DNA can provide a template for protein synthesis, in principle it probably can. But the way it is found in the cell, and we'll get to that in a second, you'll realize that most of the action with nucleic acid is taking place in the nucleus. Protein synthesis takes place in the cytoplasm, and there's a barrier for that, and you need to export something out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm.
I think the question was, if you put the cell-free system, mm-hmm. enough a bunch of ribosomes in there, and a bunch of single-stranded DNA, what would prevent it from being processed? If it's a slightly different chemistry, it just wouldn't be able to be read? You put all the adapter molecules, everything else, but no messenger.
It's a good question. DNA folding is different than RNA folding, and DNA tends to be a double-stranded structure. Now, the way I view this, it's easier to say it because we recognize what we deal with today after many, many years of evolution. The cell needs to have a molecule that has a relatively short lifetime that will lead to protein synthesis. If the cell will take DNA that is permanently present there and use it as a template without any other regulations, you'll be making proteins all the time.
I agree. I just wondered if it would work to produce a few proteins in a cell-free extract where you have ribosomes.
I'm not aware of this experiment being attempted. It might be possible to do it in a very artificial system. Because the recognition of the codon-anticodon recognition is essentially the same. So on a very small stretch that doesn't sort of suffer the possible folding requirements of a long stretch, the triplets recognition should be very similar between tRNA and RNA and tRNA and DNA. So I don't know if it answers the question, but it's actually an interesting experiment to do. But the way cells are constructed nowadays, it's essentially impossible to do. And there are, as I mentioned briefly, there are, I think, good biochemical reasons for that. You want a molecule that is sort of existing transiently in the cell that will lead to proteins without touching your genetic information that is stored somewhere else. Yeah, but again, in existing cells, there are a lot of checkpoints, and one of them is the pre-initiation complex of the ribosome scanning the messenger RNA, basically proofreading and making sure that everything is okay, and this is one of the mechanisms for protein synthesis, and this probably will not work on a DNA template.
I also noticed in the Avery quotation,
That's probably the isolation technique, yeah. But it was.
It's a polyanion, basically a cation.
Sure, but you don't
really
use it as part of the chemical formula.
Well, yeah.
The question is if you took a single stretch of single-stranded DNA and fed it with the ribosomal machinery, it is likely that there will be enough stereospecific recognition or anti-recognition in that isolated OH that RNA has and DNA doesn't that will prevent the ribosome from doing its job. It will probably not work. These pieces of machinery are utterly specific. They know the way.
But if you can
Well, you can now put evolutionary pressure on different systems and come up with artificial enzymes that will handle artificial substrates. I mean, it's not. Well, as I presented, I think that the inherent reason is that you want all your information to be stored away in a very safe place. You want to be able to transiently sort of approach that, make a protein at a given time, and get this template out of the way. So the lifetime of an RNA in the cell is minimal. It doesn't stay there for too long because otherwise your cell will continue and make the same protein over and over again. So part of the sensitivity of RNA and the different structure, and the 2' hydroxyl, by the way, is the reason that RNA is so sensitive to hydrolysis, makes sure that your template is being used and it's being discarded very quickly. So where were we? Okay, so we were at the adapter hypothesis.
Sorry about that.
Oh no, that's absolutely fine. It's much more fun than doing it otherwise in a different way. Let me just. Oh, okay. The adapter hypothesis. You all heard about it. These crazy people that were thinking about RNA, and then this adapter hypothesis is probably one of the most cited unpublished papers that Crick put together to the RNA Tie Club, Crick, Orgo, Alex Rich, and Watson. These two guys are still across the street from us at the Salk Institute, and Crick comes to lunch at the faculty club pretty often. As you can see, they're all wearing those ties. Yeah, I don't know why he didn't have it. And they all have a pin that's supposed to assign them about 20 people. Each one of them was assigned an amino acid. And I think that Crick was the tyrosine and Watson was proline, but I'm not so sure. Probably for good reasons. But so we're the adapter hypothesis, but still something was missing. And this one gene one ribosome, one protein hypothesis, of course, had to be discarded, and that happened in the early 60s when Jacob and Monod came up with some very interesting hypothesis, and that's probably the shortest-lived hypothesis I'm aware of, because the very same year they actually proved it experimentally, so they were able to discover and isolate messenger RNA. And the only piece that was missing in order to put this whole picture together was the discovery of what we nowadays tend to call soluble RNA or tRNA. And of course we know that these activated tRNAs carry the amino acids, and that puts the whole genetic code in place and explains how we take a molecule that has sugar phosphates and heterocycles and turn it into proteins that are polypeptides and have no chemical resemblance to nucleic acids.
So, during the time, it seems like
Yeah, that must have been a very, very exciting time. I think that nowadays people to be too agreeable with everything, and people tend to follow, certain topics become like the hype, and everybody just follows that, and nobody criticizes the experiment, and there's a lot of crap out there. But, you know, different times. Anyway, let's put it in cellular perspective. I alluded to that early on, where most of the nucleic acid action is taking place in the nucleus. DNA is transcribed to what we call a heterogeneous nuclear RNA. It's really a much longer version of the actual messenger RNA. This heterogeneous RNA needs to undergo processing, splicing, capping, polyadenylation. All this action again is taking place at the nucleus to form the more mature messenger RNA that still needs to be exported and localized in the cytoplasm. We recognize about three or four such families. The small nuclear RNA goes actually back into the nucleus, and the partners that by now we're familiar with are the messenger RNA that provides the template to the ribosome that contains the ribosomal RNA. tRNAs are made and provide the activated amino acids, and the ribosomes through scanning and translation create the proteins. So this is just to put everything in cellular perspective.
How well understood is
the
problem?
Oh, I would say that there's a lot to be done in this entire, I would say from here to here. So look, people recognize that localization is important in terms of creating proteins, but I'm not so sure how much is actually known about it. Okay, so pausing for a second, bringing medicinal chemistry into the picture. Almost all drugs that we have nowadays act on proteins. So traditional medicinal chemists are looking for protein targets to modulate cell function and to treat cells. So if you took a painkiller last night, it probably acted on proteins. So most drugs work on channels, receptors, enzymes, of course protein molecules. And the question is, can we start targeting RNA for the same purpose of modulating the function of the cell? Of course, some drugs that act on nucleic acids are known. Most of them are anti-cancer drugs that will work typically on DNA. So we feel that RNA is an important target for drug design, because the same way proteins are responsible for the function of the cell, their level can be, of course, modulated by working at the RNA level. Moreover, I would say bacteria and viruses, particularly viruses, are very attractive because their life cycle is heavily dependent on RNA-protein and RNA-ligand interactions. And we'll get more towards the end, we'll focus more on that. So, that's what we believe. We believe that RNA is a target for drug design, and what we're trying to do is to understand how we can do that. How can we target specific RNAs with small molecules, drug-like molecules? we need to recognize that there's very, very significant scientific challenges, because we still need to learn a lot about RNA structure, folding, and recognition, both at the experimental and the computational level. And I do believe, though, that the benefits are going to be very significant, because there are differences between, let's say, ribosomal RNA in bacteria versus humans. So there's a point that will allow us to hopefully distinguish and target only bacteria. And of course, viruses, particularly retroviruses, rely on RNA protein interactions and RNA processing for their life cycle. The question, of course, is where do you start? Because really little is known about that. So what we've decided to do was to look at molecules that are known to interfere with protein biosynthesis. All of them belong to the aminoglycoside antibiotics. These are pseudo-oligosaccharides, because although they look like sugars, they do have a highly functional cyclohexane ring in all of them. This is a deoxystreptamine ring, or the streptamine ring, and the hydroxyls on these rings are glycosylated with a variety of amino sugars. So here's streptomycin, actually the second antibiotic to be discovered, again in the 40s, and neomycin, and I'll give you a little bit perspective about that in just a second, was discovered a bit later. These were in the clinic for a long time. Nowadays they're not there really, because they have a lot of side effects, and that's a whole different issue that is very intriguing, and maybe we'll have a chance to talk about it later.
Streptomycin attacks bacterial ribosomal?
Mm-hmm. All of these compounds turn out to bind to the ribosome. And that was actually...
specific to bacterial ribosome, not bacteria.
Yeah, there's a difference. Most of these aminoglycosides, and I'll show you a bigger table in just a second, actually target the decoding region of the ribosome. And there's a mutation, there's a difference between the 16S bacterial ribosome and the 18S human ribosome decoding area that is significant and allows these molecules to distinguish between the two. Although these side effects actually come from because of other reasons. These were isolated from soils and things like that. It was definitely just after the discovery of penicillin, people started just digging everywhere. And, we return to that right now, actually, but that's what they did. So here's just a timeline, sort of putting the evolution of molecular biology next to the evolution of medicinal chemistry in its early versions. And here are the discovery of ribosomes. Streptomycin was discovered by Waxman in the early 40s. He continued and digging everywhere and got some more antibiotics, neomycin B. The kanamycins were discovered later. Just recognize the thing that we talked about. It took about 20-something years to actually recognize that these molecules interfere with protein synthesis. Their target is the ribosome. And about 20 more years until Harry Knowler was able to show by footprinting experiments that these molecules actually interact with specific sites on the 16S ribosomal RNA. 64
paper in volume?
Yeah. So here's what was known when we started. Well, I started UCSD at 94, so almost 7 years ago. This is the paper by Knowler that was able to show that these molecules have specific sites on ribosomal RNA and interfere with the decoding. Shortly afterwards, René Schroeder from the University of Vienna was able to show that the same antibiotics interfere with group 1 intron self-splicing, essentially, so RNA cleavage. Michael Green then showed that the same molecules, again, we're talking about the aminoglycosides, are capable of competing the Rev protein off its RNA target. And this is an HIV system that we'll talk a little bit more about towards the end. So looking again at some more structures, what we've done essentially was to go and compile, and you don't need to worry about the numbers. Please don't focus on the numbers. there's a lot here. But what we've done was to compile all the structures and all their activities that were known at the time, summarizing those as IC50 values, basically the concentration that requires for 50% inhibition of the different systems that we've looked at. These are different conditions, different assays, so we're not making too much out of it. We just try to recognize some trends. So we'll focus on one family.
Cyclohexane and then sugar in the patch. I mean, there are so many other chemistries that one can use.
Right. Well, not that I know of. One thing that I can say is that these molecules are really different than molecules that you would find other places. So that's already a good reason because it distinguishes it from different chemistries. We think that there's a lot of very intriguing structural properties for these molecules, and I can just jump right into that. But you have here highly substituted cyclohexane ring and those sugars, and what you have here is a relatively rigid molecules. Those cyclohexane rings in ELD or the pyrene rings are really at their preferred state in the way they show, they're shown here. Everything is equatorial essentially, so this is the stable, so they're relatively rigid. The glycosidic bonds though are somewhat flexible, and this will come up later that we realize that this rigidity plus flexibility allows them to adapt themselves to multiple sites actually and to bind different RNAs. So on one hand it's good, but on the other hand, we'll realize that these derivatives actually lack specificity.
Are they in the soil in the first place because some mold is trying to protect itself against bacteria?
Most natural products or natural product secretion by various microorganisms is to do this very thing that you just mentioned.
But this could be an actual.
Right. And
available to those molds.
Right. And right, absolutely. And in fact, there's a sort of renaissance in natural product chemistry nowadays, and we still don't recognize or don't understand why nature makes so many molecules that it does make. And that they're so much more complicated what we can make in the lab sometimes, it's just simply amazing. So it's we really don't know, but many of those things do are made to protect the microorganisms from other microorganisms. Anyway, the kanamycin, a simple family, there's some variables here. So what we'll have to do is actually to count amines. So kanamycin A has four amino groups. So that's why actually we call these molecules aminoglycosides. They have a lot of amine groups on the glycosides, on the sugars. And it's pretty inactive in cell splicing, in RevRE interaction or in translation, basically protein biosynthesis, relatively high concentrations are required to see inhibition. Kanamycin B has another amino group here, and it's becoming more active. Tobramycin, which is actually just lacking this hydroxyl here, is reasonably active. Those things are at the micromolar concentration. Sort of the classical aminoglycoside antibiotics that everybody's working with is neomycin B. It has six amino groups, one here in addition to what's shown here, and this is probably the most active molecule. So thinking about amino groups, recognizing that at physiological pHs, these are probably protonated, you're dealing here with highly charged molecules, and it's not that surprising that polycationic molecules will be attracted to RNA, which is a polyelectrolyte, a negatively charged oligomer. But that's not the entire story, because then you look at another aminoglycoside, apromycin, which has the DOS ring, this highly functionalized cyclohexane ring, and other glycosylated moieties, and it's not very active. So it's not just the overall charge of the molecule that directs it to the RNA target.
Yes? People look at the citation curve of this molecule with a number of
No, I'll talk about that. Basically, one of our missions, and here are the questions, so that's a leading question that takes me to my list of questions, and these are questions that we asked 7 years ago. What is the role of electrostatic interactions? Can we come up with a general recognition model? Can we find out if there are more binding sites on a given RNA? And specificity, do these molecules bind to other RNA targets? And our approach was to look at a variety of RNA molecules, ribozymes to more structural molecules such as tRNA, and since we're chemists, to take the natural products and make synthetic derivatives and study them and try to get some sort of a structure-activity relationship. So what I'm going to do is, I need to rush, share with you a few quick stories. The first one that was quite intriguing was that kanamycin B, and I sort of went through that really quickly, but kanamycin B that has a hydroxyl group here is always less active than tobramycin that is lacking this hydroxyl. And this puzzled us because this is true throughout all the different RNAs that were tested. And that was really puzzling because you think, here's a polar molecule interacting with another polar molecule, you remove an OH group and suddenly it becomes better. It's more greasy and it binds better. That was a little bit confusing. We're quite naive at the time, but as chemists, we just said, okay, let's make molecules. We took tobramycin, the parent molecule, and we started removing hydroxyls around the entire structure. Each molecule takes about 12 synthetic steps. I'm not going to share them with you, but we can make those molecules and study their interaction with RNA.
Did you make the tobramycin de novo, or did you get that from
Well, tobramycin is quite expensive. You try to get it from Sigma, it's about, I think, $150 a gram or something. Not unusually expensive, but if you want to do synthesis with that, it's getting expensive. My colleague, Casey Nicolau, had a postdoc at a time coming from a Japanese company that actually manufactures those aminoglycosides, and they sent us 25 grams of tobramycin free of charge. And for at that time an assistant professor without a major grant, that was useful and highly appreciated. So they were acknowledged multiple times. Okay, so here are the molecules that we've synthesized by actually taking the natural product and systematically protecting, deprotecting, and eliminating the hydroxyls. And at the time, we used the hammerhead ribozyme as our assay, just a very simple assay. This RNA, of course, the name is obvious. This is our enzyme.
Not that obvious to me. It's just the shape looks like a hammerhead shark.
Yeah. That's what.
Okay.
Yeah.
The neck is coming down with the head.
Yeah. Yeah. So here's the enzyme. When you mix it with its substrate and there's enough magnesium around, a very fast phosphodiester cleavage will take place here, giving you two strands of two different products. So what you do, you label the 5' end and you follow this chemistry. Uhlenbeck has done a lot of work on that prior to us and beautifully characterized all the enzymatic characteristics of this system and was able to show actually that aminoglycosides inhibit the chemistry step. So not the hybridization of the two strands, but actually the chemistry step. And he actually also speculated, well, he had some evidence that the aminoglycosides may actually displace magnesium.
The normal function of hammerhead glycosides is what?
Well, this is a synthetic version of a real plant RNA that actually any RNA splicing basically
splicing.
Yeah, essentially. So here's the results. Here are the results of what we saw. And just to summarize it, whenever we removed a hydroxyl group next to an amino group, we found an enhanced activity. When we removed a hydroxyl group that didn't sit next to any other amine, we saw actually worse RNA binding. So that led us to realize that what we've actually done was to modulate the pKa's of the amines. Namely, if you look at the CRC handbook and you compare ethanolamine to ethylamine, you realize that the presence of a hydroxyl group next to the amine makes it less basic. So all our deoxygenated derivatives at a given pH were carrying more charge than their oxygenated derivatives. So that was, for us, a very good indication that electrostatic interactions are really important. In fact, when we lowered the pH of the experiment, and that's not easy to do with a ribosome because they don't like low pHs, but the activity of all the derivatives became very similar, indicating that when you protonate everything, then they all look the same. One may ask, who cares if you work at pH 7 or 7.3, who cares about modulating the pKa's at this range, right? Because they all should be protonated anyway. But of course, aminoglycosides, because all the amines are sitting on the same scaffold, their pKa's, and these are just literature values, actually range all the way from about 6 to about 9. So, and many of them are around 7. So changing the pKa's of these amines can definitely increase the overall charge that the molecules will carry. The nice thing about this, about 2 years detour, was that it allowed us to explain the observation that triggered this whole work, namely, how come kanamycin B is always less active than tobramycin, and they differ in the same fashion. Kanamycin B has a hydroxyl group here, and we believe that it always carries less charge at a given pH than tobramycin. The next set of experiments was very simple. We said, okay, let's now take compounds that are not very active, such as kanamycin A, and synthetically convert one hydroxyl to an amino group. So here's a synthetic derivative, and we asked ourselves, how active is this one? Well, it turns out that this molecule was much more active, of course, than the natural product. But the interesting thing was, that wasn't that surprising by that time anymore, but the interesting observation was that this molecule was as active as a natural product known as kanamycin B. And if you look carefully, you'll realize that these two molecules are very, very similar. The only difference is that these two groups are interchanged. Okay? That led us to start thinking about binding models, and we felt, well, we played with actually plastic models. If you look at this molecule and you imagine a sort of a pseudo C2 symmetry axis here, and you flip this molecule, you realize you can actually overlay the amino groups or the ammonium groups in three dimensions very well. A primitive way of showing that is this surface electrostatics that shows that the flipped molecule carries more or less the same kind of pattern. And that led us to think about this issue that those molecules may be just, all what they do is display a positively charged surface towards the negatively charged surface of the RNA. And then it may start explaining their affinity to a lot of different RNA molecules. Well, at the time, I basically, that was the ending point when I gave a talk at the ACS. At the audience was Eric Westhoff, who's a nucleic acid crystallographer and a modeler, and he told me, I'm working on the same problem, let's do something together. And what he's done was very intriguing. He looked at that time, the crystal structure of the hammerhead was known, came from the group of Aaron Klug, and Eric took the aminoglycosides, took the coordinates, and started doing molecular dynamics. And this is basically illustrating what I mentioned to you, Doron, earlier, that these molecules typically are relatively rigid around the cyclohexane rings, but they have some degrees of freedom around the glycosidic bonds. And surprisingly, what Eric found was that if you look at the distances between the different magnesium ions that essentially hold the ribozyme together and are responsible for the phosphodiester cleavage here, the distances between the amines really fell into the same range of these magnesium-magnesium distances. This is a
simulation.
Well, I think that it's, I don't know exactly how Eric did that. He published it in JMB in 98, before we started. What we've done was something different, but.
I'm just questioning, not necessarily the reliability, I just wonder what sort of approximations went into that.
I'm sure it was not an ab initio molecular mechanics. It was definitely a molecular dynamics. And I just should say here, to defend Eric's, Eric was the one who predicted the structure of the group one intron by theoretical considerations before the structure came out. So he has a pretty good track record in this respect. This is just the same thing, looking at the different distances between the different magnesium ions, and you can see the different pairs of amino groups really fall into this same range. What does it actually imply? Yeah, this is an old slide. We can actually take the aminoglycoside, and here are the ammonium groups shown in green, and dock it into the structure of the hammerhead next to the magnesium ions, and you can see a pretty good correlation. These amino groups can hold the same positions as the magnesium ions. Now, if you displace those magnesium ions by binding of aminoglycosides, you're going to shut down the ribozyme. Now, the more, I would say, this is great. This is very intriguing. Yes?
How cooperative is this? Like, if you take away one of these amine groups, is it actually used by one point?
That's very difficult to do, because once you change the molecule, you change the entire electrostatic of the entire molecule. Because the reason that the pKa's of those amines are modulated is because they're all sitting on the same structure and they influence one another. So if you change one of them, you change the entire thing. So it's very difficult to do, but it's a very good question. I mean, there's also a limit to what chemists can do. Yes?
Can I add something about hammerhead?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's another slide that probably will do funky things. But this is the same picture that I showed you. It's a different transparency, but and here's some liquid dynamics. But the interesting thing was not that you can just dock the aminoglycoside into the hammerhead pocket, but you could actually do it in multiple orientations and configurations on conformations. So you can take the same aminoglycoside and orient it in multiple ways and still get good complementarity. So that starts explaining this promiscuous RNA binding of those derivatives. They can orient themselves to match the RNA surface in multiple ways. And that actually explained this promiscuous RNA binding, because at the same time that we were working on that, in the lab we were experimentally able to show that those aminoglycosides will bind tRNA and other ribozymes and a lot of other RNA molecules. So they do bind a bunch of different molecules. Was there a question back there, or just stretching? Okay.
It seems to provide some answer to my question. There seems to be a general affinity between the chemistry called aminoglycoside and the chemistry called folded RNAs.
Absolutely.
But we don't know why.
We don't know why.
What's similar between the hammerhead and the tRNA? The looping between?
Well, that you've probably got enough lectures on RNA folding. Maybe Kyle, you'll talk more about that this afternoon. The problem in this system, for us, of course, it's not a problem. It's a puzzle that scientists have to resolve. But it's very hard to answer this one again, because RNA is flexible. The aminoglycosides are flexible molecules, and we know that there's an induced fit happening on both molecules when they bind together. So
There are RNA molecules that they don't bind, right?
We don't know of them yet. Well, that's actually very frustrating to us, because as you'll realize, what we're trying to do is develop selective molecules, not molecules that will bind any RNA molecule. So, and we'll get there, I hope, today. So we came up with this model that we call surface electrostatic complementarity, where basically the molecules can orient themselves in multiple ways, and recognize the basically the field that the RNA fold is creating. And this can happen in multiple versions, essentially. And another, some sort of an electrostatic map that shows that is looking at the surface electrostatic of the hammerhead, again, calculated, and docking in the sort of the positively charged aminoglycoside. Okay, so what are the implications of this model? Well, we have a severe problem of selectivity. So if we would like to develop molecules that bind RNA and in a specific RNA, we have a problem here. So here's a summary of what we need to deal with. And I skipped a few things to save time. But we know that aminoglycosides, excuse me, aminoglycosides distinguish between DNA and RNA. This is good. But among RNA molecules, they tend to bind them all. So this is a challenge. We've independently demonstrated that even if you'd like to target a single RNA molecule, you would find multiple sites for aminoglycosides on RNA. So they tend to bind in different places. And you would like to target, let's say, only one of them, only the functional one. So this is a challenge that we are facing. So what we've decided to do was to focus on another system where there's a little bit more information known. And this is the HIV-1. How much time do I have? Okay. Show me. Well, I can start. Maybe we should then take a break now, and because this is getting into a slightly different RNA protein. But okay, so we'll take a break now and continue with.
The challenge you're referring to is your understanding of why.
Okay. So let me just recap and wrap up and mention that what we've talked about, our early observations regarding the importance of electrostatic interactions and their critical role. And then we talked about the recognition model that we call structural electrostatic complementarity. And this is summarized in this chemistry and biology crosstalk paper with Eric. We mentioned the promiscuous binding of aminoglycosides, and independently we've established that they bind tRNAs and things of this sort and other ribozymes. And of course, what I've already mentioned briefly, that we've been able to show that there are multiple binding sites on a given RNA, and in fact on multiple RNAs. So how do we address this issue if one would like to advance small molecules ligands as potential drugs? So we've decided to look into the HIV-1 system because this is a gold mine for RNA protein interactions. HIV, as you know, is a retrovirus, and its life cycle is dependent on RNA protein interactions. So that's a very, very brief sort of in a Scientific American, actually, it was taken from there and modified a little bit. Oh yeah, absolutely, I'm going to do it. Absolutely, I'm just giving credit because we didn't create this graphics from scratch, but we've modified it to make our point a bit clearer. So here's a human cell. And here are the virus particles, and typically what first happens is some sort of a recognition event between the surface of the human cell and the virus that eventually leads to fusion, and then the virus essentially injects its content into the human cell. That contains the entire viral genome, which is about 9,000 bases long, plus some proteins that are actually unique to HIV and are essential for its life cycle. So the first thing that happens after the RNA has been injected into the cell, it has to be reverse transcribed into double-stranded DNA. This double-stranded DNA is then integrated into the host chromosome. The reason that HIV, and I'm sure you all know about it, is highly mutable, is essentially because reverse transcriptase is not a very is not an enzyme with a very high fidelity. So a lot of mistakes are being incorporated in the step from going from the viral RNA into the viral DNA. And of course, it's a very important target for drug design. Once the RNA, the DNA, has been incorporated into the host chromosome with the help of an enzyme called integrase, transcription has to begin.
The integrase is one of the proteins that comes with the virus?
Yes. Reverse transcriptase and integrase, yes. Of course, the purpose of any HIV-infected cell is to make more HIV particles. And what happens is that this DNA has to be transcribed into RNA, essentially into the full-length RNA genome. This transcription is not very efficient. In the early phases, as we tend to call the early phase of infection, the human polymerases that now do this job don't transcribe this double-stranded DNA very well, and they tend to fall off quite frequently, and there's very little full-length RNA, if at all, viral RNA. Some small pieces are floating around.
DNA.
That's possibly the regulation, yeah. And in fact, I'll get to that in just 1 second. It will probably answer this question one way or another. The small pieces, and even if a full-length RNA is formed, RNA in the cytoplasm, in the nucleus, is going to undergo splicing and going to be degraded. This leads to the generation of very small RNA pieces that can migrate out of the nucleus essentially spontaneously without any active export mechanism. These short pieces of RNA are going to provide a messenger RNA template for the generation of, again, the early phase viral proteins. The ones that are important for us are Rev and Tat. Tat is a transcription activator. It's going to go back into the nucleus. In fact, it has an NLS, a nuclear localization signal. It's going to go into the nucleus, and it's actually going to stabilize this machinery. And it's going to make sure that the polymerase will run through all the way, creating a full-length viral RNA. This still doesn't solve the export and the sort of fate of this RNA. We need another viral specific protein, and this is the Rev protein that was again made by those short transcripts that is now going to bind the RNA. Actually, in fact, it's going to coat the entire RNA and export it out of the nucleus. This will then provide the full-length viral RNA in the cytoplasm that is essential for packaging of a whole virus, but also a template for late phase proteins. The most important one, of course, is the envelope protein that will then assemble new particles. So the life cycle of the HIV within the infected cell is heavily dependent on two small proteins, the TAT and the Rev. TAT is, again, the activator for transcription, and Rev is responsible for export of RNA. It turns out that Rev also has a nuclear localization signal that overlaps with the RNA binding domain. So what it does, it binds the RNA, carries it out, now it's an active transport, it releases the RNA in the cytoplasm, now it reveals the NLS, and then it goes back into the nucleus. So it works like a shuttle, and it's very, very effective. So once this picks up, this stage where Rev and TAT are present, the amount of RNA that is, the viral RNA that is now being produced is about 1,000-fold higher than in the early phases of infection. So once this takes off, this is going to turn into a machine that basically produces viral particles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, because the proteins that are on the surface of the virus, right. In fact, they're almost recognized as a self.
How many distinct proteins are encoded in the HIV genome?
About 15 proteins. Yeah. Also heavily dependent on frame shift and splicing and things like that.
The way the Rev subtracts the release is by concentration. So how do you know what to release on time?
I'm not aware of the answer. That's a very good question. I don't really know the answer for that. Yeah. Let me show you. Let's just focus on this. We're going to focus on this interaction from now on. So here's the what we call the high affinity site on the viral RNA. It is called the Rev response element. So I'll refer to that, to this site as the RRE. The Rev protein binds at this site. Now note that this is only about 70 bases long. We're dealing here with a very small portion of the viral RNA, but this is where the action has to begin. That's the nucleation site. Once Rev bound is bound here, other Rev proteins will aggregate around it, taking advantage of RNA protein interactions and protein protein interactions, which actually makes working with Rev really difficult because it tends to aggregate in solution.
The RNA initially, after it's made, it's not coded by other proteins, it forms the secondary structure.
I don't really know what the time frame for that, but RNAs are very rarely floating free in the nucleus, if you will. They're almost always, there are a lot of general RNA binding proteins in the nucleus. RNAs not floating unbound most of the time.
Despite that, it's still forming the secondary structure.
Right. Well, again, there's you will see that there's a stabilization of the structure by the protein, and that actually has to, those of you who are interested in RNA folding and recognition, most of the action in RNAs is happening around unusual bulges and loops. There's some in the different stems, the sort of classical A-RNA double-stranded structures, but most of the recognition events will occur around some unusual loops, and the RRE is very, very intriguing in this respect.
I'm a little confused about the numbering system on the left. It seems like it starts at 39.
Yeah, this is just a small portion of yeah. I'm sorry? Of the viral RNA. This is just a very, very small portion of the entire viral genome.
And of course, not one of these smallish RNAs
that come out? Well, the small RNAs that come out, no. This is actually is not part of the small RNAs that come out. This is found in a, I don't have the sequence of the entire viral genome here, but this actually, and the reason that we actually are interested in this interaction is twofold. This is the high affinity site for the Rev protein to bind to the viral RNA. That's where the action begins. But this site also codes for the envelope protein, so it must be a late phase and later transcribed RNA. Okay, so Well, let me step backwards for a second. The Rev protein, I mentioned that it has an RNA binding site or RNA binding motif that is also the nuclear localization signal. This is shown here. It's a highly basic, not that surprising, stretch of amino acids, about 10 arginines out of about 16 or 17 amino acids. There's an NMR structure of this peptide, and most of the work that I'm going to show you has to do with this Rev peptide. And a minimized structure of this RNA when it was truncated here. And the interesting thing about it is that when they're bound together, this peptide is highly helical. People claim that these purine-purine interactions are formed upon peptide binding or protein binding. There's a crystal structure that shows this in the absence of the peptide, so it's hard to tell. But the interesting thing about this binding in the RNA groove here is that somehow it had to evolve to accommodate an alpha helix. And this is actually done by widening the groove with those purine-purine interactions. So they're quite intriguing, and they create potential surfaces for recognition. But they're essential in accommodating this peptide into the RNA. Once this nucleation event took place, other proteins will continue and aggregate around this and over the sort of continuation of this entire RNA. So we've decided to focus on this system for the reason that I mentioned to you just now, because the life cycle of the virus is heavily dependent on this interaction. To be able to discover small molecules that will work, what we've done is developing some simple assays that will allow us to screen for that. So here's an example of one of our assays where we immobilize through bioconstruct avidin interaction the RRE to a solid support. We extend the peptide with four alanines to extend its helicity, and we put a fluorescein at the end. So now we can actually assemble on a solid support an RNA peptide complex, very schematically shown here, where all components came together. And what we do, very simply, is challenge this complex with a given binder. And what we're looking for is displacement of fluorescent peptides. So if you imagine doing it in a filter tube, where can you incubate those polymeric beads with some ligands and other things? And after a given time, you filter and you look for fluorescence in the filtrate. The nice thing about this assay is that not only it can tell us about affinity, we can add to the soup a bunch of different competitors and start addressing selectivity. And that's the main issue that we're dealing with here. Once we identify a good binder, we go to more classical biophysical studies. We use fluorescence and isotropy a lot. Basically, what you do, you take the same RNA construct, add the fluorescent peptide, and since the molecular weight and the size of this complex is much bigger than the isolated peptide, the tumbling in solution is different. You basically follow fluorescence depolarization, and you can determine very nicely dissociation constants just by following this equilibrium. If you challenge this equilibrium with competitors, you can actually follow the reduced anisotropy and determine inhibition constants as long as you know the number of binding sites. So what we've done initially was to show that these assays work, and this will tell us something about selectivity. Here are three aminoglycosides. We've seen them before. The actual names are not that critical. We get a given set of IC50s, and I will stick to IC50s throughout the talk, although here and there we'll come up with KIs. This is because we've independently demonstrated that there are multiple binding sites for the aminoglycosides of different affinities. We don't know exactly how many. So we stay with IC50 values, but the point of this slide is to show that the solid phase gives us very similar numbers to the anisotropy experiment, and that we've essentially validated and confirmed that aminoglycosides don't bind DNA very well. This is it was known and it was very useful for us. While the IC50s increase when we challenge them with tRNA, and independently we know that these aminoglycosides bind tRNA as well. We'll get there. It's about a nanomolar. I mean, the dissociation constant in vitro.
Can you get into these micromolar?
Well, you add quite a lot. Yeah. We'll get there. We do have now derivatives that actually are as good as the rev peptide, even better. We'll get there in just a second. We'll skip that. Just get to the point here. Okay, so if you remember, I've mentioned that the site that we're targeting has both purine-purine interactions that define relatively large surfaces and bulged-out bases. So these are potential sites for intercalators. So we thought, well, let's see what happens if we bring together an aminoglycoside that will provide sort of the ionic or electrostatic portion, if you will, although electrostatic is also As I said, this is a truncated version. It's essentially thinking about this going straight here, shorting this, having a loop, and going back this way. Yeah, this whole thing was truncated. And for those of you who are interested in other puzzles, RNA biochemists tend to work with what they call functional minimized RNAs. They would take a huge RNA and condense it to what they think where the function relies. This makes biochemistry and in vitro work very, very helpful. But it doesn't represent necessarily the true case. We know, although this entire stem was truncated out, when we do footprinting experiments, we see interactions here as well. And this happens throughout a lot of other studies. So it's very useful to work with those minimized structures, but they don't tell you the entire story. Okay, so purine purines and bulge out bases, potential intercalation sites. So we're wondering about bringing those modes of binding together by putting, let's say, taking the natural product and putting an intercalator attached to that. Wondering what would happen with this sort of ionic recognition and this intercalation, what would it do to the affinity of those molecules to RNA, particularly to the RRE? Well, to our delight, this molecule was one of the most potent RRE binders. Here are some fluorescent and isotropy displacement curves. Everything is calibrated to the Rev peptide, which is sort of the natural site. So you can see here the Rev peptide in blue. Our conjugate in red. Neomycin itself, the natural product, in green. And aminoacridine in black. If we assume and we feel that there is a single high affinity site for neoacridine, we can calculate inhibition constant that is very, very similar to the Rev peptide. So here we were able to get down to the nanomolar range by bringing different binding modes together. Of course, once we had this molecule, we sort of rushed to the AIDS Research Center and we told them, here's a new anti-HIV drug, just go ahead and test it. Well, they were very kind to us and they did test it. Of course, it didn't show anything. Only then, we should have done it the other way around, but you go to our assay, and our solid phase assay, and I should say that the solid phase assay is much more robust towards interference. You try to do fluorescence and isotropy with competitors, it doesn't work very well. We know that when we challenge neoacridine, that's how we call this molecule, with DNA or other tRNAs, we lose significantly in the IC50s. This molecule has very high affinity to other nucleic acids, while the Rev peptide maintains its affinity in the presence of competitors. Okay, so here we were able to solve the affinity, we're struggling with selectivity. What can we do? So very recently we decided to play the following trick. What we're dealing with, what we're competing with, is a peptide that has a lot of arginines. And we're trying to do it with ammonium groups. But that doesn't seem to be that fair. So we came up with this new family of molecules. We call them guanidinoglycosides, where we converted all the amino groups on aminoglycosides into guanidine groups. Guanidine groups are much more basic. They would carry their charge over a wider range of pHs. They are flat, they can intercalate, they have directionality in the hydrogen bonding. So we felt that these molecules should have higher affinity and selectivity to the RRE. And indeed, we haven't determined the microscopic pKa's on these derivatives. Of course, if you look at textbooks, arginines are up there into 12, 13, whatever. Amino groups are, you know, 8 or 9. But since we know that the pKa's of amino groups on aminoglycosides are modulated, it's going to be very intriguing to determine the microscopic pKa's of guanidinium groups on guanidinoglycosides. But we've just made them and studied them in the last year or so. So there really is plenty to do. So here's a table that you don't want to look at because it has a lot of stuff on it. So we're just going to pick up one line and look and see what happens, for example, to kanamycin B, one of the natural products, in terms of its IC50 values to the RRE, in the absence of any competitors, plus DNA, and plus double-stranded RNA. You can see that DNA doesn't do much to that, but of course RNA does. Here's the guanidino derivative of kanamycin B. You can see right away that we've increased the affinity tremendously, but the most important thing is that we maintain selectivity. So we're very happy with these compounds because they allow us for the first time to improve the behavior of these small molecules. So interestingly, these molecules turned out also to be active in vivo. So this time we rushed to the AIDS Research Center, and this time we were lucky. And this will open a totally new direction that we'll talk about briefly. This is one of the assays that one uses to follow HIV replication. These are HeLa cells that are infected with HIV, and basically you look at what we call plaque formation. When the cells start to release new particles, their shape changes, and that's how we actually follow that. We'll just look at only two curves. We'll compare the same family. Here's tobramycin. You can see it's quite inactive. You need very high concentration to see any activity. But at the same concentration that tobramycin doesn't show any activity, guanidino tobramycin green is at its IC50. So for the first time, we have molecules that show activity in vivo. Now, let's put the science back into this picture. We don't know for sure whether this anti-HIV activity has anything to do with RevRE inhibition. We have to do those assays separately. But what's intriguing is that when we, and this is unpublished, when we label these compounds with fluorescent tags, and one has to be very careful with the selection of fluorescent tags because a lot of fluorescent tags will get quenched in the presence of amine groups. Amines tend to quench fluorescence quite rapidly. So if you select the right fluorescent tag, and in this particular case we use Bodipi, it turns out that the aminoglycosides don't penetrate the cell very well, while guanidinoglycosides are just sucked into the cell amazingly fast. And again, we need to repeat those experiments, but what it reminds me of is sort of a new direction that emerged a few years ago when people started recognizing that highly arginine-rich peptides get into the cell relatively quickly. In fact, you can conjugate to the TAT peptide or to the REV peptide big cargos, proteins, and they will just be carried into the cell. And in fact, there's a new company that was started by Paul Wender, who's at Stanford, called CellGate, when they just try to conjugate everything to polyarginines as a vehicle to deliver things into the cell. So my personal dream here is that these molecules that contain guanidino groups will behave in a similar way, and it's not obvious whether they just are being taken so well because they adhere to the surface of the cell, to the phospholipids, and then somehow the membrane flips in, or whether there are other mechanisms of action, but it is becoming a rather general phenomenon. There's just a recent JBC paper where a Japanese group, I don't remember the name, made a bunch of different arginine-rich peptides, either taken from viruses or totally synthetic and totally random, and they would all get into the cell pretty effectively. So basically, we're doing two things. One of them is to find out how these things work. The other thing is, can we actually use guanidinoglycosides as carriers of other molecules into the cell? And we get some help from Roger Chan in our department there. So let me just summarize that by saying that we believe RNA protein complexes are going to be very important targets for drug design, particularly in the antivirals. We still face those scientific challenges in terms of understanding RNA structure, folding, and recognition, but I do think that benefits definitely justify this effort. One can imagine not only targeting new and resistant pathogens, bacteria or viruses, but also using those as molecular biology tools to modulate cell functions at the RNA level. These are just our future directions, but I won't elaborate on that. Let me just wrap it up by, if I have two more minutes, just by showing some of the statement made by pioneers in this field, and I was really amazed when I read that. It's from almost 35 years ago. One of the pioneers in this area sort of wrote an introduction to an entire, that's basically the introduction to a book summarizes a conference that was taking place in London in the 60s. And the interesting thing is that what he says is that antibiotics are selective agents provided by nature for our enlightenment, and we can hope from the study of their action not only to improve our knowledge of the application of known principles, but also to find new principles. And I thought this was actually quite intriguing because more and more people are looking now into small molecules, RNA interactions. The other thing that he says here is that the interaction of proflavin, actinomycin, etc. with DNA show us a new principle whereby we can inactivate a functional macromolecule by distortion of its structure. There may be further examples of the same general principle, or there may be another principle altogether to emerge from the studies of the interaction of ribosomes or other forms of active RNA with streptomycin, chloramphenicol, tetracycline, etc. So one ACS meeting, I ended up the talk with that, and then another ACS meeting, I added another portion of this prophecy, if you will. And I put this thing up, and we can actually skip all this thing, but what he ends up with saying is that we can certainly talk about drug design now with far greater confidence than we did 8 years ago. This is in 1866. In another 8 years, we may well be controlling disease with drugs built to order. Well, that was a pretty optimistic and probably unrealistic if we look back at those statements. We're still struggling quite a lot with drug design, although we know much more. And here and there, you would find sort of... Where? Oh, yeah. I may use that. Okay, so let me just end by acknowledging the people that actually did the work. And Hai and Sarah were some of the first generation of people to do RNA chemistry in the lab. The lab is actually doing a lot of other things. Most of the work that I've told you about was done by Nathan Lutke, a very, very talented graduate student, and was helped by a lot of other younger people that are now joining the lab. I have to acknowledge some colleagues for their inspiration and help and support, and again, thank you for the invitation.